Okay, so we are now coming to the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right stillness, samadhi. And this is all, as we shall see in a second, it's all about the four jhanas. So when we talk about samadhi on the Buddhist path, it's specifically samadhi. It is about the jhanas. And it's important to understand that samadhi, when it is used, sometimes it is used as a word, not with a samma prefixed. Still, it would generally have, if it doesn't qualify it in any other way, it will normally refer to the four jhanas. That would be the normal designation of the word samadhi in the suttas, simply because it is used so often, simply it's because it is the most important example of samadhi by far across the suttas. So, to get a handle on these things, one of the problems, of course, once we start to read about the four jhanas, is that they are described in a certain way, and there's always a matter of interpretation. What do these things actually mean? So to help that interpretation, I want to talk a little bit generally about the jhanas, first of all, before I read this out, and just to give some ideas of how these things, how these states, how these qualities, how these achievements, whatever you want to call them, are described in the suttas, how they are kind of qualified by the Buddha. And this will give us some idea of what they actually refer to as we go through the states afterwards. And one of the things that is important to keep in mind with these jhanas is that they are always praised very, very highly by the Buddha. The kind of terminology that he uses to talk about the jhanas is very, very lofty here. And it's almost always on par with the te vidya. Remember, the te vidya are the three like true insights, the recollection of past lives, the understanding of karma, and the arahatship, the destruction of the asavas, and the becoming an arahant, awakening itself. And the jhanas and the te vidya are usually put roughly on the same level. They're obviously not exactly on the same level, because awakening is more profound, but they are usually grouped together as one category here. Right? This tells us something about the profundity of these things, that they're almost always grouped together on par with each other. And some of the names that are used for these things, for all these different qualities, is like Uttari Manusadhamma, often translated as superhuman states, or states, qualities which are beyond the human, if you like, right? And this is basically the te vidya, and again the jhanas. There's also some other things in there, but those are the main kind of types of experience that are included in this Uttari Manusadhamma. So superhuman states, right? Beyond the human realm, beyond our ordinary experience. That's essentially what that means. Then you have another appellation for these states, so these qualities, and that is Alang Arya Nanadasana Visesa, which is usually translated as something like knowledge and vision worthy of, distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, right? Worthy of the noble ones. In other words, this is what the Aryas practice. This is what the Aryas have. This is what the Aryas do. Worthy of the noble ones. Again, the basic things there are the four jhanas and the te vidya. There are some other things like some superhuman, supernormal powers, that sort of thing. But these are the essential qualities in there. Worthy of the Aryas. Interesting too, jnana-dasana is in there. So that means that the jhana is called a jnana-dasana. Jnana-dasana usually refers to insight. You have yata, bhuta, jnana-dasana, knowledge and vision of things as according to reality. Here, the jhanas are included in jnana-dasana. It's fascinating, and this points again back to this thing I've been trying to, you know, one of the things that I've been saying on this retreat, this idea that as you practice this path, both vipassana and samatha are cultivated all along. Jhanas are not purely states of samatha where there is no insight. It's impossible. If you have very, very deep calm, you will also have profound insight. These things must always go together. And even before, even to be able to enter a jhana, you have to have very deep insight. You have to understand basically the whole karmaloka, the whole sensual realm. To be able to abandon something, you have to understand it first. You can't abandon something unless you have understood it. It's the understanding of it as dukkha and a problematic that actually enables you to abandon it in the first place. So this again shows you that insight or vipassana and samatha always go together, to the point that even the states of jhana themselves are called jnana dasana, knowledge and vision. It's quite interesting how this actually works. So that is the second appellation, again a very lofty appellation for the jhana states. And then it is called the Sambodha Sukha. This is another one you find for the jhanas. Sambodha means awakening. So the jhanas are called the happiness of awakening, right? Of course, awakening itself presumably is the happiness of awakening. That kind of goes without saying, you know, awakening must be the happiness of awakening. But the jhanas too are kind of happiness of awakening. In other words, you're getting very close, right? It's almost equivalent. It is the kind of state that even the arahants, even the Aryas enjoy, to get away from the impacts of the world and the problems of life. They enjoy the jhana states. These are happiness of awakening. Another one, which is very interesting one, is in the Chula Hati Padopama Sutta, a shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint in Majjhima Nikaya 27, which is the one I did here, the sutta I did here 2 years ago, which is all about the gradual training. In there, it talks about the footprint of the elephant, right? How it's a simile of the footprint of the elephant. Now you see a footprint in the forest, and can you straight away jump to the conclusion that this is a naga, this is like a big male elephant? Can you jump to that conclusion straight away? No, you need more information. You need to see the scraping high on the trees, the branches that have been torn off, and then eventually you come to the clearing in the jungle, and there sits or lies down this big elephant, and then you can come to the conclusion, this is a naga, this is a real big male elephant, and then you come to that conclusion. And in the suttas, the footprints of the Buddha, the footprints of the Tathagata, in other words, those things that you can start to know that there's something very important going on here. What are those footprints? The four jhanas, they are the footprints. And then you have the recollection of the past lives, another footprint, understanding of the laws of the karma, and then when you reach awakening, do you actually see, this is it, this is the bull elephant, this is like the Buddha in this case. So the jhanas are the footprints of the Tathagata. You know when you come to the jhanas that the Tathagata, the Buddha, also has been traversing this territory. You can actually start to recognize the Buddha at that particular point. Right? So all of this is very profound. And what all of this points to, and there's more as well in the suttas, I can't even remember all this, all the praise for the jhanas throughout the suttas, there's so much of it. But what it all points to is that these are very, very profound states. So when we are starting to talk about interpreting and understanding what these things are about, then it is very likely it is going to refer to something very, very different from what we normally understand. And I have always used this idea to help me in my interpretation of what these things are, to guide me, in a sense, onto understanding what the jhanas are. And when I hear an interpretation which is very profound, I tend to be leaning in that direction. That is the kind of interpretation that I would agree with. When somebody says, "Wow, this is very, very profound, it's complete stillness, absolute ending of karma loka, no feeling of the body and the senses, all that kind of stuff," that is where I place my confidence, because it fits very well with how this is described in the suttas. One other sutta that I should perhaps bring up in this connection, which is not mentioned here, is another nice sutta in the Anguttara Nines, I think it is. I can't remember the name of that sutta now. No, I think that would be hard. It is a sutta which talks about the disturbances in the various levels of jhana experience. What that sutta says is that hearing is a disturbance to the first jhana. Vitakka vichara is a thorn. It's called thorn, the whole sutta, I think, or thorns. So hearing is a thorn to the first jhana. Vitakka vichara The movement of the mind is a thorn to the second jhana. And so it goes through a large number of nine thorns to various things. So what does it mean? Well, what this means is that it's a thorn in the sense that it stops you from entering, right? If you have vitakka vichara, you're not in the second jhana. In other words, if you have hearing, you cannot be in the first jhana. This stops you from entering the first jhana. Now, if you know a little bit about your meditation experience, you know that the senses die down in a certain sequence, right? The smell and taste of obviously disappear quite quickly. You don't really not concerned about those. Seeing disappears fairly quickly because you sit with your eyes closed. It doesn't have to disappear quickly. You can still see through your eyelids, but it tends to disappear fairly quickly. And then feeling disappears, right? Gradually the feeling of the body, you're left only with the breath, and then eventually the breath also disappears. And the last of the senses to disappear usually in the sequential cessation of the senses is hearing. Hearing is usually the last one. That's why hearing is the thorn to the first jhana, because it is the last thing of the senses that blocks you from entering these profound states. And again, that shows us that basically the five senses are absent when you get to the jhana states. That sutta also has a parallel in the Chinese, which presumably means that it is a fairly authentic and early version of the Buddha's teachings. So these are just some of a little bit of the background information for how we should approach these states, how we should understand them in accordance with how the Buddha teaches these things. These things are very profound. And sometimes people say, oh, when am I going to get to jhana? And I say, well, don't worry too much about that. There is so much happiness, so much tranquility, so many nice things to be experienced before you get to the jhanas. Enjoy that. And then one day, if you enjoy that in the right way, by being content and happy, then one day you might even get to the jhanas. But these things are very, very profound. When you get there, you are on the doorstep to awakening itself. Okay. So now we are going to back to this sutta called Analysis, the Vibhanga in the Pali, in the Magga Sanyutta of the Sanyutta Nikaya. And now we come into the analysis of the last factor, Samma Samadhi. So remember, now we have purified ourselves completely. We have gone through everything. We have done the final last purification through the Satipatthana practice and the Anapanasati practice. The mind is now perfectly pure. The sutta I had in between here called Mahanama shows you also a little bit about what happens at this stage, about how you go through the various types of happiness and how you move towards Samadhi. It's very similar to the very first sutta that we had a look at on this retreat. But again, it just shows you, reinforces this idea of how from mindfulness Samadhi arises through the meditation process. But now let us look at the definitions of Samma Samadhi. And what, bhikkhus, is right samadhi? Here, bhikkhus, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. With the subsiding of thought and examination, he enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of samadhi. With the fading away as well of rapture, he dwells equanimous, mindful and clearly comprehending. He experiences happiness with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, he enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called Samma Samadhi. Right samadhi here. So this is a exposition how these jhanas are described in the suttas, and people who are able to attain these dhanas, they say that these descriptions are astonishing in how somebody is actually able to describe these otherworldly states, for which normally you have no vocabulary, no way of describing these things. They are astonishing that somebody is able to describe these things so precisely in such a good way. These are very good description of something which is very hard to describe. So let us have a look at this and try to understand what is going on here. So first of all, secluded from sensual pleasures, viviceva kamehi, one of those. Vivica, secluded, right? Apart from, aloof from perhaps, or certainly apart from, sensual pleasures, kama. Here, kama is in the plural sense, which means sensual objects. It means the world of sensual objects. That's what you are secluded from in this case. This is one of those small little things of Pali grammar, or whatever you want to call it, that kama in the singular normally refers to the desire. Kama in the plural almost always refers to the objects of the five senses. Here it is in the plural. Kamehi is a plural noun, and it refers to the objects of the five senses. So you are secluded from the objects of the five senses. In other words, the five senses don't operate anymore. Secluded from unwholesome states, vibhicha akusalehi damehi, unwholesome qualities of the mind. This refers, of course, to the five hindrances, which one of which is kama, kamachanda. So not only are you secluded from the objects of the senses, you're also secluded from the personal desire for those things. Those things go together. Only when you get rid of the desire is it possible to get rid of the actual objects themselves. It goes together. The attachment must go first, then you can abandon these things completely. So here you are secluded from this, right? Secluded means like apart from, you are entered another world where these things cannot get you anymore. You're completely separated from these things. So, and then based on that, you enter and dwell in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination. Thought and examination, vitakka, vichara. So this is where people think, yeah, you hang out in the first jhana and you reflect, you think about this, you think about that, because vitakka vichara is there. But again, we have to be very careful with these kind of interpretations. If the mind is thinking, it's not a very profound state of mind. And remember that here we are moving towards the very end of vitakka vichara. In the second jhana, vitakka vichara disappear completely. It's avitakka avichara, there's nothing left. So this is the very, very last remnant of vitakka vichara. So it is very unlikely that it is thought and thinking and pondering and examining in any ordinary sense of the world. It's the very last remainder. So what is the very last remainder of vitakka vichara? It is the slight movement of the mind that still occurs. So this is how these words are often used. They are often, because there isn't any word in a natural language for the slight movement of the mind, you have to use ordinary words like vitakka vichara, but show that this is the most refined version of these that is in existence. You may have noticed before, we were looking at the Dveda Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thought, right? In that sutta it says, first of all, you abandon the wholesome thoughts, right? Then you abandon the unwholesome thoughts so as not to tire yourself out, right? So all thinking is abandoned, unwholesome, then wholesome. And then what happens? You enter the first jhana, right? So that is an example which shows you that the abandoning of thought happens and then you enter jhana as a consequence. Another good example for why this is the case you find in the Chinese translation of these things. In the Chinese translation of the suttas, the Chinese agamas, you find that the words vitakka and vichara are translated in different ways when they use the ordinary thinking and pondering and when it is used in the sense of the factors of the first jhana. Different translation, right? And the reason for that, again, is obviously that these have different feeling or meaning to them. So if it was translated into Chinese in the same way, it would have been misleading in Chinese, and that's why they have changed and altered the translation. So here too, it is a little bit misleading to translate this as thought and examination into English, because it gives all the wrong kinds of association. And I think in these kind of cases, you could translate them just as movement of the mind. And that would be enough. Accompanied by the movement of the mind would, in my opinion, be an adequate translation in this case. And then the last one, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Seclusion from the senses, seclusion from the hindrances. So that once that seclusion arises, right, you abandon the Kama Loka, you enter the Rupa Loka. At that point, a special type of happiness, a special type of Piti Sukha arises. And this is the Piti Sukha born of seclusion. It's a higher type of Piti Sukha than you have experienced before. A more refined one than you have ever experienced before. It is called the Piti Sukha born of seclusion. Okay, that is the first jhana for you. This is how it is always explained in the suttas, always the same phrasing. And of course, it's very fascinating that when you look at some of these phrasings, and this is also, I think, very interesting, gives you a lot of confidence that we still have the Buddha's teaching today. When you compare the phrasing here and you compare it with how it is given in Chinese, how it is given in other places like the Sanskrit, right? And you compare, remember, these things have been apart for 2,300 years, probably. Right? And you read them, and the first jhana is explained word for word in exactly the same way in the Chinese as it is in the Pali. The same thing is true for the second jhana. In the third jhana, there's some slight, small, very minor changes or differences, which don't really make any material difference as far as I can see. But it is essentially word for word the same after 2,300 years. And that gives me a very strong confidence that this is exactly how the Buddha described these things, right? This is what the Buddha said. He was sitting there, the Buddha was talking, and people were hearing these very words. So it's kind of hair-raising when we hear that. So, jhana number one, jhana number two. So remember, these are different states, right? It's like you enter from one room to another one. You enter from one state to another state, and suddenly click, and you've kind of gone into a different state, right? Moving from state to state, that's what we're doing. These are different experiences, and there isn't really anything in between, except there is something in between the first and the second jhana called the kind of one and a half jhana. There is such a thing, but beyond that, there is nothing really in between these things. So, with the subsiding of the movement of the mind, right? Thought and examination, the movement of the mind, the subsiding of the movement of the mind, the mind becomes utterly still. He enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without movement of the mind, and has rapture and happiness born of samadhi. So now the movement comes to an end, and internal confidence, what is that confidence? You are confident in the object. That's why the mind doesn't move anymore. Full confidence in the object. You stay with the object 100%. There's no kind of sense of to-ing and fro-ing, but absolute confidence in that object. This is what unification of mind means here. The mind is fully unified in one thing, no movement anymore. So this is what I was talking about before. Sometimes you hear about Advaita Vedanta, which is this Hindu philosophy. Advaita means literally non-duality, right? Well, this is the Buddhist answer to non-duality. This is what non-duality is in Buddhism. When you enter this state, it is completely unified. There's no distinction between you and what you experience anymore. Usually we feel we are here. The experience is kind of out there. There's a difference between the experiencer and the object. Here, it all disappears, and it's Advaita. It is a non-dual state. From here onwards, all the way to Nibbana, in terms of Samadhi, everything is non-dual. So this is unification of mind. Ekodibhuta is the Pali word for that. Having become one. It is without movement of the mind and has the rapture and happiness born of Samadhi. For the first time you have attained full Samadhi, right? This is why this state is called Samadhi. Precisely because it is fully unified, no movement anymore, only one experience, going on and on and on, hour after hour, no change whatsoever. So this is another level of rapture and happiness, another level of Piti Sukha. It changes again. It feels different from the previous one. It's not the same thing. This is the Piti Sukha born of Samadhi, Samadhija Piti Sukha. With a fading away as well of rapture, he dwells equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending. He experiences happiness with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana of which noble ones declare. He is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. So the rapture fades away, piti fades away. This up until now you have always experienced piti and sukha together. Now rapture fades away and only sukha is left. And this is called the sukha of equanimity, the happiness due to equanimity. So you are equanimous in the third jhana, but there is a happiness due to that equanimity. Mindful and clearly comprehending. Right here, what this means here is that here mindfulness is moving towards the very peak of mindfulness. The happiness is disappearing and the mind is becoming very, very even. Mindfulness is becoming strong, and you will feel that, especially after you come out of the third jhana, you will see that the mindfulness is more powerful than it has ever been before. Same thing with clear comprehension, of course. You understand more clearly than before what are the good states and the bad states. Happiness is starting to fade away, right? Piti is fading away, and yet you feel better than ever before. This is a better state than the previous one, even though the happiness is actually starting to fade away here. This is how clear comprehension arises. You start to see where the true pleasure, the true happiness actually is to be found. And he experiences happiness with the body. Now this is a bit of a, needs to be explained. With the body here is kayena. Remember I was saying before, the word kaya is very used very idiomatically in the suttas. It doesn't have a very fixed meaning. It doesn't actually mean with the body in this particular context. It would be very strange if at this point you started feeling lots of happiness with the body, in my opinion. So what it means, and this is a contextual thing that you get from reading broadly in the suttas and seeing how these words are used in different contexts. What it means personally or directly or immediately. It's a direct experience of happiness, a personal experience of happiness. This is what it means. So it's personal, direct, and immediate. Right? Because the kaya, sometimes you have in the suttas, you have a namakaya and a rupakaya. The rupakaya is a physical body. The namakaya is a mental body. This is a distinction you can find in suttas like the Mahanidana Sutta. They make that distinction. And here it is the namakaya that you are experiencing with the mental body and not the physical body. So it means a direct, immediate experience of happiness. Why is that? And the reason is because you have just left piti behind. Piti has been left behind, so now all you have left is sukha. And it's the first time you experience pure sukha without piti. So it's a direct experience of sukha. So you have an immediate experience of happiness, of pleasure. This is what is actually meant by this expression here. So, and this is actually how it was translated by Venerable Bodhis. A teacher, Venerable Jnanaponika, he actually did translate it as a direct experience, but then Bhikkhu Bodhi has gone back and translated it with the body again, which I think is a bit of a shame. It's like you have lost some of the correct meaning there, in my opinion. Here, anyway, so he enters and dwells the third jhana of which the noble ones declare, the Aryas, right, the other ones who talk about these things, and they say, the equanimous one who is mindful, he dwells happily. He's equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. You could also translate as the equanimous one is mindful and dwells happily. I like this kind of understatement in the suttas. Right here, you have finally, you have gone through all the possible happinesses existing in the whole world. You finally reached the very peak of happiness. And only then do you dwell happily, right? It's just, this is kind of, okay, now you're happy. Before, it was just, playing around approximation. This is now you're happy. It's nicely understated. And the suttas are like that. They are quite understated. When the Buddha says you're happy, he doesn't kind of mess around. He reads, you are really, really happy. You're in the third jhana. If you are one-pointed, again, it means second jhana, right? He uses this very understated language to talk about things that are very profound. So please remember that when you read the suttas, because otherwise you might underestimate the profundity of what is going on sometimes. Okay, so now we come to the fourth jhana, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure. He enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called Samma Samadhi. So, abandoning pleasure and pain. It's a bit strange that we should start talking about pain now, because pain has been going on, been left behind a long time ago. But the point is that pleasure has just been left behind. Sukha was still present in the third jhana. And sukha and dukkha are a pair, right? They function together. So if you fully want to abandon the pair, you have to abandon both sides fully. And that only happens at this particular point. The same thing with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure. This is somanasa and domanasa. Now, piti is an aspect of somanasa, so that was abandoned in the second jhana. So then also the two sides of the coin were abandoned in the second jhana. They go together here. So this is why it is phrased in this way, as far as I can understand anyway here. So you abandon these things when you abandon both sides of this. Then you enter and dwell in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, adukkama sukha, right? And includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. Now mindfulness reaches its absolute peak because of the equanimity, the even-mindedness of the fourth jhana. And this is one of those remarkable things about this whole thing. Remember, as you're moving through these hierarchies of states, with each state that you're going through, you feel more and more happy, more and more pleasurable, more and more wonderful. And here, at this particular stage, you have abandoned all happiness, right? And that state in which there is no happiness, where there is neither pain nor happiness, is a more pleasurable state than when you just before was experiencing the highest happiness in samsara. So to be really happy, you have to abandon happiness. It's kind of a weird conundrum, isn't it? It's a strange thing. And when you are really equanimous, completely even-minded, it is a better state. Subjectively, it feels better than actually feeling happiness. And this is when you start to understand that how profound these things are. It's almost impossible to imagine these things. You're going to have to experience it to understand how this can possibly be the case. So this is what makes these things so extraordinary. You start to try to think about these things. And then you go, of course, from here, you can then move into the immaterial realms. And trying to understand what those immaterial realms are like, it's almost impossible to understand in any ordinary sense. You look like the realm of nothingness, right? You literally experience nothingness. That's what you experience. How can you experience nothingness? And that then is the highest, most pleasurable experience you've ever had. It is very hard to grasp these things. They become, they are like words used to explain states that are incredibly, incredibly refined. So, there you are. Those are the four jhanas. And this is the ending of the Noble Eightfold Path right there. It ends with the fourth jhana. Just as the seven bhujangas ends with upeka. Of course, that is similar to the upeka here that we find in the fourth jhana state. This is where it stops. And once you have that, you have the whole basis, the whole platform you need to attain any kind of state you want. This is the foundation. From here on, everything happens more or less automatically. All you have to do now is just turn your mind in the right direction. We shall see that in a second. And when you do that, things just kind of fall into place. And you start to reach the final awakening on the Buddhist path. So, let us quickly go through those three levels of awakening, the Tevija, that comes afterwards, the three types of awakening that the Buddha talks about, the three insights, if you like, true insights, the Tevija. And this is now we have to go outside. We have now finished the Noble Eightfold Path. And what we're looking at now are the consequences of practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. This is what happens when you practice this path. And this is how this is explained in the Bhaya Bhairava Sutta. This is the Buddha's, again, autobiography. He's talking about himself and how he attained awakening. And in many, many other places, we are supposed to follow in the same tracks. So this is how it is explained. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the recollection of past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives, that is, one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. And this is how he recollected it. There I was, so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance. Such was my nutriment, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term. And passing away from there, I reappeared elsewhere, and there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such was my life term. And passing away from there, I reappeared here, in this life. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. So, when my mind was thus purified, when my concentrated mind was thus purified, this refers back to the experience of the fourth jhana. So the sutta, just previously to this, it has been going through the four jhanas. So this refers to that. And you could translate this differently because of the grammatical structure here. It would be appropriate to say, when my mind had been thus stilled, right? When it had been thus stilled, when I had attained such samadhi. In other words, the samadhi comes first, then comes the recollection of the past lives. It doesn't happen within the samadhi. This is a sequence of events happening here. So when my mind had been thus stilled, when my stilled mind had been thus purified, perhaps. So purified, right? No hindrances, no problems there. Bright, incredibly bright mind at this point. Unblemished, nothing to blemish the mind. Rid of imperfection, that is different ways of saying the same thing. Malleable and wieldy. This means that the things that stop the mind from being used in all kind of different ways are the hindrances. Like when you have sloth and torpor, the mind becomes completely stiff and rigid. You can't move it any way, this way or that. You don't know what to do. This is the opposite. The mind is very, very gentle and easy to work with. You can direct it any way you like, and the mind just follows along. Very, very easy. So this is why it's called malleable and wieldy. And of course, it is very important if you're going to direct it to things that are very hard to see and very profound and perhaps also can give very strong emotional reactions because they're very painful to see. It is important to have a mind which has this wieldiness and malleability to it. It is steady and attained to imperturbability, anenja patto. And again, the idea here, anenzapato, is the idea that the mind is not moved anymore, right? You have gone beyond pleasure and pain. Because you have gone beyond pleasure and pain, that is what the fourth jhana is about, pleasure and pain doesn't move you anymore. You know that there is a state which is more pleasant than pleasure and pain. Because you know that when you see suffering in the world, when you see problems, it is not going to affect you very much. You're going to be able to deal with it. The mind is imperturbable, not being moved by worldly phenomena anymore. So this is the kind of mind you need, right? When you have that kind of mind, then, of course, you can do things that otherwise you might would be impossible to see because it just would be too painful, too difficult to be able to deal with it. Then he directs the mind, right? The mind is malleable. You can direct it wherever you want. So he directs it to the knowledge of the past lives. That is one birth. So you start off by going back one birth. You go back in this life, back until you were a baby, right? Perhaps into your mother's womb. I'm not sure exactly how this works. And then suddenly you make the jump. And you are an old person dying on the other end, right? And then you make the jump into the past life. And then you can see the past life. And then you can move backwards like that. And this is why I think it says one birth. You go one birth first, and then stage by stage backwards. And then you do all these births, right? Backwards and backwards and backwards. 100,000 births. Wow. I must be going very, very fast to be able to recollect 100,000 births. And then you have eons of world expansion. This is the vivatti, the vivatta of the world. Vivatta means the world is unfolding quite literally. The way it is translated here, it sounds like it is sounds like the Big Bang, right? The world is expanding, the world is contracting, like the Big Bang and Big Crunch. But the Pali doesn't really allow you to infer that the world actually is expanding or contracting. The Pali just uses the word vivattati, which means like unfold or evolve. It's very close to the word evolve, actually, because the word evolve comes from the Latin word volvo, or volve, which means to roll, quite literally. And vattati in sangvattati also has the idea of rolling on. So evolve, right, and devolve are very, very close to vivattati and sangvattati in a literal translation. So it means the evolution of the world, and then the dissolution of the world, or devolution, whatever way you like to translate it. So that is probably a more literal translation, but it may very well may very well be the case that this does refer to the Big Bang and then the Big Crunch and that sort of thing. But you cannot really deduce that from the Pali. And then, of course, you have all these knowledges, right? You know very precisely about yourself, all these various things. You know that such was my life term, that's when I died. And then passing away from there, you get reborn in a new life. You know everything about that life. You know, such was my experience of pleasure and pain. So you know what that life was like in terms of the feelings you had. And then you pass away from the second life and you reappear here. And this is what I was saying. Here means in this world, in this particular life. Idda loke. So this is what I mean when I was talking about a couple of days ago, when I was saying that when you recollect past life, it's a very structured kind of thing. It's not just random pictures coming up in your mind, kind of seeing random stuff, which could be anything really. It is a structured sequence of things happening, moving from existence to existence. And you can see the causality. You can see how you evolve over time, how you change from being one person, going into another character, another life, and how character, your personality changes over time until you appear in this life, right? So it is a very precise kind of memory. It's not something that can really be misinterpreted. Moreover, because it is based on the fourth jhana, it is a very, very clear memory of what is going on. Much more clear than ordinary memories we have in ordinary life. This is like, bang, you are there. You know, this is a re-experiencing of something with incredible clarity here. So that is the recollection of the past lives, and you see all these things happening. And this is when you start to become a little bit weary, right? When you see this 100,000 lives moving up and down, you start to think, oh, maybe I've had enough of this. Maybe it's time to find a solution to this problem here. And this is why the Buddha then says in the last paragraph here, and it's the next paragraph here, this was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides heedful, energetic, and resolute. true knowledge, the first true knowledge, right? The first true insight. This is the vidya. I think it's very nice to call it insight because these are the real insights, the real understandings, right? Now you see for the first time, ignorance was banished, delusion was banished. Avidya, delusion, is the opposite of insight here. Delusion is banished. Now you see the world for what it actually is. True knowledge, insight arose. Darkness was banished, right? We're wandering around in darkness, roaming around from life to life, not understanding what is going on. For the first time you understand. Somebody turns on the light, and wow, this is what it's like, right? This is what the world is. You break your little chick is sitting inside the eggshell for many, many, I don't know, how long do they sit inside eggshells, the chicks? I don't know, probably many weeks, right? And you think this is the whole world. And then one day you break out of the eggshell and you see, wow, this is the reality. It is so different from what I thought it was. So this is obviously very, very powerful. And you see here that this insight into the past lives is the same, explained in the same way in terms of the qualities as the understanding of karma, and also in the same way as the final breakthrough to arahantship itself. Every one of these is the turning on of the light, the banishing of the darkness, the coming out of the eggshell. All of those are roughly the same. So all of these are very profound and deep understandings of the reality of existence. It's hard to see these things, hard to really relate to these things fully. So please don't feel that, you know, this is just a little bit too much. I can certainly understand when people say this is too much. I don't want to hear about this. You come to the Four Noble Truths and people say, whoa, hold on a minute. I'm not sure if Buddhism is for me after all. This is just too much. And they think it's pessimistic and dark. But so an important principle in Buddhist practice is always to, those things that are too profound, don't just chuck them out and say it is wrong because you can't relate to it. Instead, put them to one side and be pragmatic. What am I experiencing on the path right now? And what you are experiencing right now, most people, is an improvement in happiness, right? You're reducing your suffering. You're actually going somewhere. So the path works. So because the path works, it is worthwhile having confidence, some degree of faith in those things you cannot understand. And then you just keep on doing the thing which actually works, which gives you more happiness, gives you more meaning in life, and then gradually your eyes will start to open up and you will start to see the more profound aspects as the practice goes on. And if you never see them, that's okay too. At least you get the happiness of practicing the path. Okay, number two. When my mind had been thus concentrated and purified, bright and blemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. I understood how beings pass on according to their actions. Thus, these worthy beings who were ill conducted in body, speech and mind, revilers of the noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body, after death, have reappeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination, in perdition, even in hell, or just in hell. But these worthy beings who were well conducted in body, speech and mind, not revilers of the noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a good destination, in a heavenly world. Thus, with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I understood how beings pass on in accordance to their actions. So the same kind of samadhi, the fourth jhana, You attain the divine eye which surpasses the human. This is a mental eye, right? Not the physical eye. This is when you go into samadhi, you close your eyes and you see these things with a mental eye. You see the devas and all these kind of things. And you see the passing away and reappearing of beings. You can kind of watch beings passing away and then reappearing. Inferior and superior is here hina and panita, I think. Hina, panita. Fair and ugly, can't remember that, what it is in Pali. Fortunate and unfortunate, that is sugata and dugata, literally gone well and gone badly, quite literally. This refers to going to good and bad destinations. And you then see how these beings, you see, literally see the laws of karma. You see how this operates, right? You see the actions and you see the results. And then so what are the bad actions here? Bad conduct in body, speech, and mind. Interesting, the revilers of the noble ones, right? If you revile, you know, talk badly about the noble ones, or maybe even revile them to their face and that sort of thing. So this means we have to be a bit careful how we talk about other people. This is here mentioned as a particular type of bad karma that leads to a bad destination upon rebirth. So that's quite interesting. It's something we haven't seen so far, which is new to this particular text. Wrong in their views. So wrong views is bad, but particularly when you give effect, it says here, to those wrong views in their actions. So the point is that wrong view, if it really is a wrong view, it will have effect in how you act. Wrong view and action must go together. If you don't act upon those wrong views, it means there are not fully wrong views yet. There's something which holds you back, some sort of right view that stops you. But if the wrong view is fully taken hold of and accepted, then of course you will act in accordance as well. This is why wrong view is so bad, because it does lead inevitably to acting in accordance with that. And then, because of all that, because of ill conduct and bad actions and the reviling of the noble ones, the really bad actions, then you reappear in this bad destination, right? These are the states of deprivation. This is like the animal realm, or the Peta realm, right? The animal realm and even the hell realms. We have those in Buddhism as well, although of course here they are temporary. And then you send yourself there yourself because you feel so bad about how you lived your life that when you have your life review, you say to yourself, I deserve to be reborn here. And because you think that's what you deserve, that's what happens. And then we have the other ones. The other ones are the ones that are well conducted in body, speech, and mind. They are not the revilers of the noble ones. They praise the noble ones even. And that is then very good karma, it's the opposite. And they are right in their views and giving effect to those right views. And then you reappear in a good destination in the heavenly world. The world even there doesn't really belong there, so just good destination, comma, in the heavenly world. So this is how you see things. You see basically how this law of karma operates from one life to the next one. And then we have the same thing. This was the second true knowledge, the second insight attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Delusion was banished. Insight arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, heedful, right? Energetic and resolute. Right? That's all it takes. Interesting, isn't it? All it takes on this path is to be heedful, energetic and resolute. That's what happens if you do these things. So if you are heedful enough, if you are diligent enough, if you are have enough energy, this is what happens. This is what you see here. This is what he's saying here. It's all about applying oneself. It's all about commitment, all about perseverance. Enough commitment, enough perseverance. This is what happens. It's fascinating that is kind of the cause here for getting to all these things. It's the application of the Noble Eightfold Path in the right way, of course. That is what gives these kind of results. So I think one of the things that you're starting to see here, not only in the when you see the first vijja, you understand rebirth, you start to understand suffering and the problem of existence, the roaming, the pointless roaming about from life to life. And here, what I think you start to see, you start to understand the mechanism behind that, and you start to understand that there is no guiding principle here, right? There's nothing which guides you so that you always go to a nice destination, always go to the right place. And because there is no guiding principle, you're starting here, I think, to understand that this is a selfless process. I think here you're getting close to understanding the idea of non-self. Because if there was a self, presumably that self would have some guiding influence, right? Would help you to move in the right direction. But what you're seeing is that there's all this bad and good karma being made due to cause and conditions. And there's nobody in charge. There's nobody controlling this. There's nobody helping you to move in the right direction. So I think here, this is the kind of thing, it's starting to probably dawn on the Buddha at this point. He's seeing very clearly that this is anatta, this whole process. The full insight hasn't happened yet, but it's probably getting very close. So he's seeing dukkha, he's seeing anatta to some extent. And anicca, of course, is very much part of this as well. So then we are ready for the very last part, the very last insight of these tevijas. And when my mind had been thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas. This is the asavas. Asavakaya jnana is what this is called. The destruction of the asavas, destruction of the root defilements in beings. And when he directed it to that destruction, then the Buddha says, I directly knew as it actually is, or I directly knew according to reality, this is suffering. I directly knew in according to reality, this is the origin of suffering. I directly knew according to reality, this is the cessation of suffering. I directly knew according to reality, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. The Four Noble Truths. We are back to the beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path again. We have full insight into that Noble Eightfold Path. At this point is when you become a stream enterer. The Buddha, it seems, didn't go through stream entry and all those stages. He went straight from the fourth jhana to becoming an arahant. But of course, the same insight is required. But in his case, it seems arahantship happened immediately. Right, so you directed to the destruction of the taints. And remember, one of these asavas is the asava of existence, right? The asava of sensuality has already been abandoned by the Buddha at this point, or the Buddha-to-be at this point, because he has already abandoned the kama loka. So now the most important asava remaining is the one of existence, and also the one about ignorance. So ignorance and existence are the two that are remaining. And now, because he has seen the problem of existence, the process of rebirth, he is ready at this point, I think, to renounce existence itself. Existence has become seen as pointless. Worse than pointless, right? It's pointless, plus it is suffering on top of pointlessness. Pointless suffering, roaming around from birth to birth, just experiencing a bit of happiness here, a bit of suffering there, lots of suffering here, perhaps lots of happiness there, but still a kind of pointless thing going around and around. And he has now found something much more, he's now inclining his mind towards something much more peaceful than all that. So he has seen, he is ready to abandon existence itself. And so this is the asava he's now ready to abandon. And this is very closely related to ignorance itself, to the abandoning of delusion. And that's why he's able to see this is suffering. He has quite literally seen this in his past life recollection, and now he's expanding that to understand the five aggregates. Every experience, everything you can experience is problematic. He's taking that last leap, so to speak, and accepting that as a truth. And that is when he can abandon the very desire to exist itself can be abandoned. And of course, also part of that is understanding the origin of existence, that tanha is what drives this whole thing. As long as you want to exist, you will exist. It will drive you on from life to life. take away the desire to exist, and then the whole thing just comes to a natural halt by itself. And this is what we mean by the cessation of existence. Samsara just comes to a halt. It just ends. Nothing is being destroyed. Nothing is being annihilated. This is the very important distinction between annihilation and cessation. It's just a natural ending of phenomena, ending with cessation itself. So he sees that, and that's the third noble truth, and part of this is also understanding the path itself, right? He has just been through the whole path, and now he fully understands how that path works. Then he also has this insight in a slightly different way, and this is, I directly knew, according to reality, these are the asavas, these are the defilements. I directly knew, according to reality, this is the origin of the asavas. I directly knew, according to the reality, this is the cessation of the asavas. I directly knew, according to reality, this is the way leading to the cessation of the asavas. So he understood these profound things, and this again is something that you understand when you become a stream entry, because you understand what these things are and how they come to an end. It's just, I suppose, it's just a slightly alternative formulation to the Four Noble Truths. I'm not entirely sure, to be honest, why it is formulated in this way twice, but I think the point remains roughly the same. So, he understands the ending of the taints of the asavas. Possibly one is the understanding of suffering, and the other one is understanding the path in terms of defilements, and that might be the difference here. Anyway, now coming to the very last part, when I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the asava of sensual desire, the kama asava, from the asava of being, the bhavasava, and from the asava of ignorance, the avijasava. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated, I directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. When you have that understanding of stream entry, and here for the Buddha everything is happening much faster, then eventually arahatship must happen as well. So when you know and see this, your mind is liberated from these asavas, from the underlying underlying defilement, sensual desire. You have no more sensual desire because you know it's dukkha. You have no more desire for existence because you know that's dukkha too. So you have let go of that completely, absolutely. No more craving for that. And you have seen reality as it actually is. So avijja, ignorance, delusion, is also completely abandoned. All defilements have gone. When the mind is liberated, you don't think, am I liberated or not? You don't have any uncertainty about that. You know it is liberated, right? This is the knowledge. Arahants know that they are arahants. And if somebody is in doubt, well, that is one way of knowing they're not arahants. So, I directly knew, and this is kind of also the interesting thing, which I always like to point out about these things. What is it that the arahant knows, apart from the fact that his mind is liberated? He knows that birth is destroyed, right? The holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. This is the knowledge they have. Basically, that samsara has come to an end. This is equivalent to the ending of rebirth. So again, to take out rebirth from the suttas, almost renders the whole idea of awakening null and void. And there is no awakening anymore. What are you awakening to? Well, that whole thing you're awakened to disappears, and it doesn't exist anymore. So it is integral to the suttas. This is what you know when you become an arahant. This was the third insight attained by me in the last watch of the night. Delusion was banished. Insight arose, darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who abides, heedful, energetic, and resolute. So, that is what happens when you practice in the right way. You literally see the light, you understand things as they actually are. And it's very profound, it's very hard to really fathom, these things until you actually have the insights, until you get close to these things. So just keep them at the back of your mind until you get there. In the meantime, just enjoy the progress of the path itself. So there you are. And I just added this last little line at the very end here. And the reason I added this is because this is the joy of hearing the Buddha's teaching, right? And this is what this monk Tissa, he went to the Buddha and he was feeling down, the path wasn't working. He was just tired and sleeping and he couldn't get anything done. And then the Buddha gives him a teaching. And at the end of that teaching, the Buddha says, "Rejoice, Tissa, rejoice, Tissa. I am here to exhort. I am here to assist. I am here to instruct." So that is when you do the Buddhanusati and you understand what the Buddha is really about, then you rejoice in being able to get instructions from such a being who has understood the world in such a profound way. So, there you are. That is the end of all of those suttas. There's one sutta in there which I haven't done, but that is it. Very powerful and beautiful stuff, all this. So tonight we can have one more session of Q&A, and then tomorrow perhaps we can summarize a bit and talk about things in general. So we'll see you again this evening.